Hello, welcome back to The Gambling Files. This is the RTFM episode, Read the Fucking Manual, where we take a deeper dive into things that are interesting. Well, do you know what? They might not be interesting to you. Maybe I should just say we take a deeper dive into things. That would work. I'm John Bruford. I'm one of your hosts, joined by Fintan Funtool Costello. Fintan, hello.
Hello, John.
Damn glad to have you here.
I'm glad you let me keep coming back, so it's really appreciative.
Well, do you know what? It's awfully lonely on the internet if you're just spewing words into the ether. Fintan, we're joined by none other than Amanda Brewer. Do you remember Amanda? She's the country manager for Canada for the Kindred Group.
She is, and she's also slumming it with us, so we're very, very grateful.
Yes, well, hello, Amanda.
I'm very glad that we have a friend in common, and he thought of me when he was approached about this topic. So it looks like it's worked out for all of us today.
Well, totally. Amanda was recommended to the podcast by friend of the podcast, Brad Broderick, who I told Brad that he has the most American name in the world. So him being Canadian just fries my brain.
He does a bit sound like he should have been like part of that, you know, Barbie and Ken package, you know, like Ken's best friend in a sports car with really
totally.
Good hair and sunglasses.
Yeah,
you know?
And a jaunty scarf for winter. and somebody that wears their jumper over their shoulders, which always blows my mind when I see people doing that.
Although Brad, I saw recently, he does have very good glasses and good hair. So he's halfway there already.
Yeah, and, you know, North America, you know, Canada being America's hat, he also has good teeth.
Well, it's a check mark for our dental plan up here, I guess. Universal health care.
Everybody wins. So what we touched on in the TLDR episode, we'll reiterate a little bit here. Fintan was behind some research for bonusfinder.com, who are his alma mater. And it led them to the conclusion that Ontario is going to knock all other iGaming markets into a cocked hat, as we say. Fintan.
Yes, John.
Tell me why. Why?
It's really simple. It's all about market access. So if we take, like Amanda said, New York's had a huge amount of focus put on it from a legislation perspective over the last couple of months, but even the last couple of years. So when we look at the US market, New York and kind of California are seen as two of the linchpin markets that are meant to make all these crazy valuations that we see in the US make sense. What we've seen in New York is they've issued licenses, but they've only issued 9 licenses, and it's sportsbook only. So what you've actually got is a oligopoly type situation. So it's a very limited access market, and it's only for one product. So despite New York being, you know, it's a just under a 20 million population, give or take, it's kind of a tastemaker for a lot of the world and for a lot of America. It's not actually, and it'll be a competitive market and it'll be an important market because of the population size for the 9 licensees. But when we actually look at it overall, there's only, you know, you're still going to have an offshore casino market, or you're still going to have people traveling to New Jersey to place, if they want to gamble on casino. And so you don't have a very robust market condition set up. When we compare it to Ontario as the example, so Ontario's got slightly lower population, so you look about 15 million, give or take, so you know about 5 million less. But we're estimating there's going to be about 70 licensees, probably more. There also, it's going to be legislation for sportsbook, for online sportsbook and online casino. And so straight away then you're creating an environment where there's a lot of competition. There's a large addressable market, and you can operate a full product range. And then when we put that in comparison to, say, a New Jersey or a Pennsylvania, because of the population size and the number of licensees, Ontario easily becomes the number one North American market. That's it. It's just data. Now, that's my opinion. What I would love to know from Amanda, who's actually on the ground and is a massive Canada expert, does she agree? Disagree? Thoughts?
Well, that's the hope, because if you think about when the government launched its intentions or declared its intentions to open this market, they had a few really important public policy objectives they wanted to achieve. And one of them was really to create a very open licensing market so that it was going to be easy for operators to come in and get licenses and come into compliance. And they wanted to make sure they had the full RG protection for Ontarians that wanted to sign up and get accounts. So it was really protecting the public and making sure that they had safeguards there in place, but also making the license accessible. So I guess as I've been trying to talk to Americans and Europeans about the market here, the thing to remember and the one of the biggest differences between Canada and the US is the US was a black market until PASPA was repealed. Whereas Canada has been, let's just say, conservatively for the last, 10 years, but really since forever, it's been gray, which means that while the activity is not legal in Canada, we don't prosecute. And there have been no prosecutions and no penalties assigned against any operator for being in Canada, whereas the US, there were horrible penalties. So with states opening up now, you have a greenfield expansion of gaming. It's not like you have a whole bunch of customers who've had accounts and they've been wagering and placing bets on sports and they're very familiar with the product and how it works. We actually have that up here. You could consider Ontario to be a mature market because anyone who's wanted access to these products has had access to the products. The only thing you haven't seen is above the line advertising for anything other than our lottery corporation. So it's an interesting dynamic for Ontario to now shift to license. And I think the surest way to try to eliminate the black market, because if you don't have a license by the day the market launches, you will be a black market operator, is to really open it up as fully as possible. And the Alcohol and Gaming Commission of Ontario, when they did their consultations, and full credit to them for spending the time and speaking with operators, they made the decision to open up as much as possible because they knew that the more restrictions in place, the more you enable the black market to continue. If you have a population base that can basically get whatever it wants right now in terms of online gaming or sports betting, launching a market that suddenly starts to take away features just means they'll go seek it somewhere else in an unregulated market. So full credit to the AGCO for recognizing that. Where it will get interesting is, we're thinking 40 to 50 operators maybe with licenses for launch day and more coming into compliance after that. But on the sports betting side, you will have some of the biggest operators in the world that are going to come in. It's going to be very competitive, especially in Toronto for advertising. But you also have some operators who've been in here for a long time and you have others who haven't. So where you're starting to see some of the anxiety, well, maybe not anxiety, but angst ratcheting up is for the likes of, the Score and DraftKings and BetMGM and PointsBet Canada, who have never been a gray market operator. So for them, they're interested in getting that market launched as soon as possible so they can start going aggressively after customers. So that's kind of my long way of saying, we think that there's a lot of credit owed to the province and its regulator for recognizing that the best way to bring operators into compliance and to making sure customers don't find black market options is to make sure as many products are available when that market is open.
And I totally agree with you. So I suppose my next question is why has Ontario got it so right then versus say a New York or other states in America where it's a very limited number of licensees and product?
It's not limited to America though, is it? This is Germany, etc.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a very good point.
I'm gonna give a bit of a glib answer, and I don't mean it to be, but I think gaming is very much tied into politics. And I have spent 10 years traveling across Canada, speaking with different lottery corporations and regulators and provincial governments, trying to convince them to license and regulate the online market that was alive and well within their borders. For Canada, I mean, and it's similar with the States, gaming is conducted and managed, which is a unique term to Canada provincially. So it means Ontario can only concern itself with what occurs within its borders. It cannot dictate policy in any other province, nor can any other province tell Ontario what to do. So Ontario has been very free to reinterpret or expand its interpretation of conduct and manage to allow them to put this system in. But this didn't come overnight. We had to wait for the right government to come in. We had to wait for the right conditions, you know, in terms of the political environment. Because, you know, if anyone was paying attention to Toronto, maybe 10 years ago, we were trying to put a very small casino in the downtown core, and it was roundly defeated by the local city council. So in some respects, we're still very puritanical in our approach to gaming. We can expand access to alcohol and beer. We can expand access to cannabis. But when it comes to gaming, there's, for reasons I've never been able to appreciate, still the perception that it's a far greater slippery slope to Sodom and Gomorrah than any other vice out there. So I think for other states, it's just, you know, the political pressures, they know their constituents, they know what their appetites will be. There's usually a lot of nervousness that comes with the expansion of gambling. And also it depends on their relationships with their terrestrial casinos and if those casinos are tribal or not. We don't have the same level of tribal gaming in Canada that they do in the US. And those can be pressures that get exerted as well. So the tethering model that we see in many of the states is really a way of making sure that existing partners, whether they be tribal or not, are not left out as those markets start to open. These are just some of the reasons, but a lot of it does have to do with politics.
Got it. And so you've talked about like the open licensing process and how to, because obviously the easier and the wider they make the net and bring people in the fold, then the easier it is to regulate. And then ultimately it's that responsible gaming protection for the players, which is the key thing. But there are like, what restrictions will be in place? Like, are there advertising restrictions? Are there other restrictions that are coming in as part of the legislation?
There will be a few. And the way we've positioned it, in sort of, you know, discussions with the Alcohol and Gaming Commission, it's walking before you're running. So going back to, you know, this is a mature market, but it's been hiding behind the scenes. It's been hiding underground. There hasn't been a lot of above the line advertising. So at least initially, when operators come in, there will be no public offering of bonuses or inducements. So you won't be driving down, you know, a highway in downtown Toronto and have all these billboards screaming at you with really enticing, you know, numbers on them. So operators will be able to put all that information on their websites and in any direct marketing to their customers, as long as the customers have opted into that communication. But you won't be seeing, you know, TikTok or Instagram or Twitter with all kinds of, you know, numbers floating out at people. So I know there's been mixed reactions. Some operators feel that will really enable a level playing field because the operators will be coming in all different shapes and sizes. And anyone who's not a really big one is not going to have the budget to be able to throw at those sort of bonuses and inducements like you're seeing down in Arizona right now. And others are grumbling that it's really unfair. So the AGCO has signaled that once the market is up and running and people are behaving responsibly, then, you know, they're open to having that one revisited. And right now we're going to see what happens with the volume of advertising. That's not something the AGCO can regulate. So they're hoping that the companies like Think TV for the television side, interactive media for the online stuff, print, and the rest will come together and sort of self-regulate or self-police on this, because we're heading into an election in June in Ontario of 2022. And you can appreciate, for a population that is already slightly adverse to the expansion of gaming, even though this is not an expansion, it's just the regulation of an activity that's been taking place for a long time, the fact that all this advertising is going to be popping up, the last thing you need is unhappy constituents calling up the local, you know, municipal, provincial offices and yelling at them for corrupting their children. So, you know, there will hopefully be some restraint in the advertising online and on TV as well. I mean, we've never seen that happen before, right?
That's the so the gambling industry is going to show some restraint when it comes to advertising. That's the hope.
Well, I mean, if you think about a advertising block on television, and you know, it's what, every 10 or 15 minutes you get a couple of minutes of advertising. So if all of a sudden that starts going full sports betting or for full, you know, sports and casino ads, there will be problems, there will be complaints, and then the government will step in and say, you get no advertising because I'm tired of having, you know, people yelling at me. So we'll have to see what will having
a wide open market mean for players. I mean, does this just mean like better, sexier bonuses? I mean, does it mean like the cost of player acquisition is going to be up on the one side? What does it mean?
I think player acquisition costs are where some of the big spending is going to be initially, because remember, we have operators who have no players right now. So they'll be aggressive in trying to get some. And we've seen some sponsorship deals that have started to get announced. And, you know, that's really all about brand awareness and starting to get people ready. But I think if you've been a serious punter, you've got your three or four accounts already, and there's not going to be much about Ontario opening up that's going to make you want to move off them. They'll have to re-log in again, because there's going to be some new requirements for know your customer. And so they'll just have to log back into their accounts and, you know, provide a couple other pieces of verification, but nothing will change for them. I think if you consider what the mobile experience will be and the live in-game wagering experience will be, so for those people who are going to be now watching, you know, a Leafs hockey game or a, you know, a Raptors basketball game, I mean, if you're going to be in the stands, that will be one experience. But if you're at home now and having sort of that extra layer of excitement, of fun added on to the viewing experience, I think that's really where people are expecting there to be a lot of pickup. And that will probably be where some of that new customer acquisition will come from, is providing that new fan experience.
What are you anticipating as being sort of the key? what are the big money areas going to be for players? So I know the lottery company there has casino games in its offering, doesn't it?
So the Ontario Lottery and Gaming Corporation, or OLG, has been the only legal purveyor in this province, and they've had casino games, and they've launched Parlay Plus, which is their sports betting product, and they've got lottery product as well. But I don't think anyone in the industry is expecting them to be a serious competitor. This is the kindest way I can put it.
Okay, but in amongst the suite of products that are going to be, you know, the breadth that's going to be on offer, what are you anticipating are going to be the key markets for the operator, for the suppliers, for the operators?
I think slots and table games will be really big. I mean, the sports we know is low margin, low handle. I think there's a lot of economic activity that gets generated around the sports betting. You look at the partnerships, you know, for Curling Canada, Golf Canada, Canland Sports, which in Ontario are the arenas where you go send your kids to play hockey. So there have been a lot of partnerships that will certainly be beneficial. A lot of our leagues, like the CFL has one with BetRegal, and the CFL certainly sees that as an important lifeline out of COVID. So for those, you can appreciate where the benefits will be on the sport side. The thing that's interesting about some of these pan-Canadian sponsorships is the best that they can do in other provinces is brand awareness, or you might be able to sign someone up for a social account. But the only legal gambling will be in Ontario, and it will be geolocated. So you don't have to live in Ontario, but your feet will have to be planted on the ground in Ontario for you to place those wagers, much like it is in New Jersey. So I think the sports will definitely have a lot of the you know, the visible advertising tied to it. I think it'll have a lot of the excitement tied to it because of, you know, we're waiting for MLSE, Maple Leaf Sports Entertainment, which, you know, Raptors and Blue Jays and Leafs are all part of that consortium. And that is the big cherry that, you know, we all expect some combination of FanDuel and DraftKings to be awarded. So that has a lot of the sexiness attached to it, but I think the money makers will really be on the casino side.
I think we're all about the sexy on this podcast. I think I speak for both of us.
That's why there are no images, right?
That's too sexy.
No. We would just be distracting people. Although there was talk about me selling my big shiny head for advertising if we ever switch to video. In terms of the sports side of things is kind of often that's kind of how you get the player in the door, isn't it? And familiar with the format, downloading the app, etc. I know this is probably going to sound like a really stupid question. And somebody once said to me, there are no stupid questions, but there really are. How hot is the sun? I mean, which bit? But anyway, what are the key sports? Because the key sports for participation are not the same as the key sports for betting necessarily. So, you know, there's a World Cup next year of football or soccer, as some people like to say. Is that potentially going to be big? Because I know Canada's it's a very multicultural kind of country. Presumably the NBA is big. Hockey's obviously absolutely massive, but what are the big betting sports?
You know, it's an interesting point because a sports enthusiast or sport fan isn't the same as a sports bettor. So you look at, you know, sort of what Canada or I'll stick to Ontario. You look at what Ontario has access to, which is anything and everything because of subscription-based sports channels and because of the amount that we get up through the U.S. We watch a lot of U.S. sports in Ontario. So if I were to sort of say, you know, what would I want to be concentrating on? Hockey for sure, but there's also the NCAA football. So you look at some of the college football. We don't have the same college sports experience in Canada that they do in the States. So college basketball, maybe a little bit during March Madness going on, but not that much. But really, you know, college football, hockey, some NFL, some NBA, some baseball. But tennis is a really big sport up here for betting. And then anything with the Olympics as well. Now it's super seasonal, but we are heading into a Winter Olympics. Canadians tend to do very well in the Winter Games. So I expect there'll be a lot of bookmakers putting out enticing promos and offers on the Winter Olympics. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the sports books can offer just about everything and anything, but we'll have to see what kind of uniqueness comes out because it's Canada. I mean, maybe curling will end up being in the top 10. I have no idea.
Well, it was you mentioning curling a minute ago, and I suddenly thought, well, hang on a second. Actually, Canada is culturally quite different from the US, despite, as mentioned, being its hat. And suddenly, when you throw curling into the mix, you know, a lot of the mergers and acquisitions that have happened of late have been actually about acquiring some of the British talent in odd setting to incorporate into North American companies because we have decades and decades of that experience over here mm-hmm. and a lot of talent in that respect. But I'm pretty sure they would take one look at curling and say, no, lads, sorry. No, you're shit out of luck. I'm not setting odds for that.
Well, it's a uniquely Canadian sport, and it's not the only, we're not the only country in the world that plays curling, but the passion for curling is something that you would have a hard time explaining to a lot of other countries, I think. Every city has a curling rink in it, and we have big briars that, you know, are televised on, you know, CBC Sports. when they happen. And there's a lot of airtime devoted to their games and their rinks when they're over at the Olympics. So we just had the pre-qualifying rounds, I believe, for the men's and the women's over the weekend, and we were victorious. And I'm sure there were a lot of people that were sitting watching those games. I am not one of them, but that's okay.
I know a little bit about the whole phenomenon of curling and the madness surrounding it, because there was a movie made like nearly 20 years ago. There was a movie about curling,
probably made by Canadians for Canadians.
It very much was, and in fact it has Canada's only television stroke movie star in it, which is Paul Gross. I think he's the only actor in Canada, but he wrote and directed it, and it's called Men with Brooms.
Yes. I have a very faint recollection of that coming out.
I would expect you to have the poster for the movie over your fireplace.
Yes. No.
Where's your national pride, Amanda?
That's called hockey, which we don't call ice hockey here in Canada. It's just hockey. We don't confuse it with ball hockey or field hockey or broom hockey or any other kind of hockey. So we never need the qualifier of ice in front of it. When people say ice hockey,
everywhere in Canada's frozen.
Yeah. When people say ice hockey to us, we know that they're normally Europeans.
Yeah, because we have proper hockey here. I'll get my coat. Sorry. It sounds like it's going to be amazing. And it's something you mentioned earlier is really, really interesting, because I do some freelance work with Necton, who do some of the player protection software, and they are working with, I think they're working with the Ontario Lottery to help them do their player risk rating software. Mm-hmm. But what's potentially really interesting here is, in a market which is essentially very open and which is designed to be very open, understanding that the black market is the part that you really don't want, what's going to be really interesting is how the responsible gaming side of it evolves. I think that has the potential to be really quite a fascinating facet of this.
Well, I know that I haven't gone in to do a deep dive into the regulations again, but there are very specific and strict RG requirements that have come out both on the AGCO side and the iGaming Ontario side as well. There will be some sort of RG certification that the operators will have to attest to. At some point, there's going to be a provincial self-exclusion portal. So if a customer self-excludes on one operator's website, then they'll self-exclude on all. And there is going to be a requirement that a percentage of advertising budget is allocated to RG ads as well. So it is something that they're going to take very seriously. The lottery corporations, because we haven't had, you know, regulated online gaming anywhere in Canada, so I can only speak to the land-based operators and the land-based facilities, but they have really made a significant investment in their RG systems, and we have really good researchers and really good experts across Canada in responsible gambling. And I know that some of the best of them have been hired out by some of the operators as well to come and help shape their program. So it is certainly something that, you know, the AGCO and the government is putting front and center as this market opens, because, you know, we talk about it a lot up here, but wanting the market to be sustainable. So we don't want things that can, you know, detrimentally impact people. We don't want revenue to be derived from problem gamblers. We want assistance for people who need it. And we want people to be able to engage in this activity in a way that's safe, responsible, and fun for them. So, you know, there's no point in doing things that make it unsustainable for our customers or unsustainable for the operators. So if you want this activity to survive and thrive, then, you know, approaching it responsibly, is the only way to do it.
Are the operators kind of coordinating together is there like a Canadian betting and gambling group, or?
So we have the Canadian Gaming Association, which has been around for well over 10 years here. It's headquartered in Toronto, but it works across Canada. A lot of those operators have started to come in as members, and that will be one way for them to work together. There's been discussion about launching in early 2022 a sports betting integrity working group, because operators here will have to sign on with an integrity monitor. Sports books will have to sign on with an integrity monitor. And we know in discussions with the Canadian Olympic Committee, Soccer Canada, Canadian Centre for Ethics and Sport, one of the education avenues that they're interested in is for athletes, junior athletes. So not the professional ones, but the junior ones. And so, you know, bringing together some of this, you know, the operators, bringing together maybe it's the International Betting and Integrity Association that already has a lot of this educational material, and some of the sports communities, and bringing them to the table and making sure that there's access to training and development materials for their athletes. So I think there's a lot of ways that the operators will be able to come together. I've had a Zoom call with Dale Hooper, who was just hired just ahead of me as FanDuel's country manager. And, you know, we'll be bitter enemies as we battle it out for market share, but on things that make sense, like integrity and responsible gambling and, you know, investments, you know, into growing this industry here, by all means, we're happy to work together.
Love it. And obviously we've talked a lot about Ontario, but what about the rest of Canada? So once Ontario regulates, what do you expect to happen in the other provinces?
Grumbling, lots of grumbling. the challenge in other provinces, because they've all come and knocked on the door with the AGCO to ask them what they're doing. So they're all aware and they're all watching. So Saskatchewan and Alberta are the ones that are further out the door than the others. So they have some RFIs out, RFPs, and they will look to have limited online sports, limited casino, largely a tethered model. And the challenge, unfortunately, I keep going back to, because Canada's been gray for so long, and then the operator who's wanted to has come in and set up shop, unless you go a fully open market like Ontario, you'll never be able to eliminate that gray market. So even if Alberta has a tethered model, they'll still have a pretty vibrant, you know, gray market community in that province. BC and Quebec are refusing to acknowledge that what Ontario is doing is legal. So I see them as being longer holdouts, but again, with a very flourishing gray market operating within their borders. And some of the other provinces like Manitoba and the Atlantic provinces are very small population wise. So, you know, it's much like the states. Not all states are equal in terms of their attractiveness or their rationale for investment. So it's the same up here in Canada. So I think you'll see some tethered models launching in provinces, but unless they go the full Monty like Ontario is doing, they'll never really realize the full potential of opening the market up.
Got it. And excuse my ignorance, because I don't know enough about it. Under a tethered model, when we look at, say, the Kanawaki tribe and their licensing regime, do they coexist? Is that like, is there anything, I don't know, like if I've, you know, I think I could imagine a scenario where the industry goes full circle, and maybe if I've got a Kanawaki license again, does that allow me to operate in a province where there's a tethered model and things like that?
It depends who you ask, but the answer from an Ontario perspective, and probably from any other provincial perspective, is no, because the Kanawakis are located in Quebec. And if you go back to what I said earlier, which is gaming is conducted and managed provincially. So if you look at any other province, they would look at Kanawaki and say, you can do whatever you want in Quebec, but your license does not entitle you to carte blanche across the rest of Canada. The tricky part for Kanawaki is the Quebec government has never recognized them. And, you know, that's a whole other podcast on that topic. Rightly, wrongly, a lot of people would argue wrongly they haven't been recognized. Because they don't have a working relationship with their provincial government. There's no backing or support for that model, and they've had a really tough fight. So any operator who's had a Kanawaki license in Ontario, there was no recognition of that. Just like any operator with a license with the UKGC or Gibraltar or Malta or New Jersey, they all still have to come in for licenses in Ontario. Your license somewhere else does not automatically entitle you to one in Ontario. So it'll remain to be seen what Kahnawake decides to do. I think operators will probably still use their services to access rest of Canada, because rest of Canada will remain gray when Ontario opens. But it does not give them an automatic in Ontario or anywhere else.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, because I remember the old days when everybody had a Kahnawake license. It was the cool thing to have.
Yeah, well, it's the absence, and I mean, full credit to them. There was no other way to get a license, and they recognized an opportunity, and they've been working very hard at it. So, in the absence of any other license in Ontario or in Canada, I should have said, you could come in and get one from Kahnawake. But the challenge is, just because they've given you one doesn't compel any other jurisdiction to recognize it.
Sure. Because when we look at Europe, for example, the old way was the Malta license would allow, because of EU kind of cross-border rules, it would allow you to passport into other countries. So it kind of created this scenario where you were licensed and allowed to operate, even though the local government didn't really like it. And so it's taken a while for the local state regulators to... and you've got the same situation you'd had in Australia, where they were using the Northern Territory license. So the Northern Territory, and then because there's an interstate treaty that you're allowed to conduct cross-border trade, then it was a way. So everyone had their servers in the Northern Territory and then could trade across Australia. So I was just curious if Kahnawake was maybe a similar scenario because of interstate treaties or things like that as well, but clearly not.
It would be way easier if we had a Canadian license and then you could just decide which province you want to go into, but we don't even have one single stock exchange. These provinces have a long history of not liking each other and disagreeing with each other and not cooperating with each other. So yeah, unfortunately, I mean, the only good part is we have fewer provinces than there are states. But yeah, any province that opens, operators will have to go sort of province by province by province, and whatever.
Got it.
Differences there are, the differences that they'll have to respect, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, the dream is having a Canadian, you know, access point, but probably not in my lifetime.
It's good to have a dream, though.
Yes.
Aim high.
Yeah.
Yes. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a serious education, and hopefully you'll come back on and talk about, you know, the land of your forefathers. Right? I mean, I don't know how many fathers you have, but
only one that I know of.
Well, that's good. I've only got one technically, but I keep hoping that one day I'll find out it was somebody else. But no, in all seriousness, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for coming on and sharing your knowledge and expertise with us. It's been tremendous.
It was brilliant. Thank you, Amanda.
My pleasure. And if anybody has any follow-up questions, ask John or Fintan.
Well, we'll just tell them to listen to this again. Yeah, if you don't find your answer, play it back again slower. Or even backwards. Let's see if we've been communing with the devil.
Again.
yeah, that was a bad episode. Moving on to our second guests. In that song, Hey Boy, Hey Girl, Superstar DJ, here we go. Dum, 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 dum. That one, the Superstar DJ that they're referring to is actually Roz and Sharon from AG Brief. Roz Wade and Sharon Singleton, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hello, thanks for having us again.
It's a pleasure, John and Fintan.
That's very, very kind of you. We all know that is very kind. Roz, Sharon, Asia at the moment is... Things just seem to have sort of erupted a little bit the last week or 10 days or so. And we want to discuss two things going on today that in the TLDR episode Sharon referred to as being quite closely linked, about Alvin Chow's arrest, the Sun City Group Holdings chairman, and the Wynn Junkets court ruling. First of all, what's been happening with Alvin Chow and what are its wider implications?
Can I actually just say something before we go any further?
Yeah.
I just realized that I could get us all into an awful lot of trouble. When I say that they are related, I mean that they both have quite significant impact and implications for the junket industry and VIP. Not per se that Wynn is linked with the Alvin Chow case or anything like that. So just making that clear.
No, it's a very good clarification. I appreciate it. I do sometimes forget that this isn't going to be, it's not like doing doing an interview and then editing it for print.
We also forget people actually listen. So
luckily there's only a couple. So
couple of thousand. Okay. Sorry.
Well, you know, top 10 in many territories, I think.
We are actually, it's a fun fact.
Which just goes to show that in some territories there aren't 10 podcasts. So two disparate stories that are similar only in the wider impact that they might have on the Asian gambling industry. What's going on with Alvin Chow? What's happened there?
Well, I'll start off and maybe Sharon can add a bit more details. I'm sure she's been scouring the news for over the last few days about this. But effectively, Wenzhou province in China issued an arrest warrant for Alvin Chow, as you say, the chairman and CEO of Sun City Group Holdings, which is probably the biggest junket operator, very famous, well-known, across Asia and Australia. And subsequently, so this was Friday, and subsequently the Macau police then took him in for questioning, and he is now in a Macau jail. This is really, in context, a huge part, really, of China's ongoing, very serious crackdown on cross-border and offshore gambling. So, maybe Sharon can add a bit more color to the story, but it's massive news. I mean, effectively, they have arrested somebody, a junket operator, for operating a junket business, which is
It is interesting. There are a few more details coming out right now, but Roz makes a very good point. The first statements that came out very much describe the activities of what junkets have always done, which leads to the question, why now? But subsequently, there's been a few more clarifications today, and it seems like the real focus, the thing that really got the authorities wound up, was that he has been operating online gambling primarily from a platform in the Philippines that's been targeting the mainland. And this has been China's real bugbear, all of the online gaming firms around Asia that have been targeting mainland Chinese and causing, as we know, billions and billions of capital outflows from mainland China, which they say has become a security risk.
And Sharon,
security risk?
I'm wrong, but when was it? 2019 that he was named by the Chinese authorities as potentially, doing something wrong along these lines. And he denied at the time that Sun City had any online business. Is that correct?
He did. That is correct. Yes. I believe that may have been proxy betting that he was actually denying at that particular time. But yes, it was quite a big case, and Sun City came out hard and fast. And basically, I think he even issued a statement himself. He denied it. It was in July 2019, actually. And but obviously it would appear that this may not have been the case now.
Where do you start?
Well, yeah.
With the security risk thing, I mean, how do you define a security risk? Am I missing some subtlety here?
I think it's just the sheer amount of money that's leaving the country. Obviously, China has a fixed exchange rate. It's not directly convertible, and having that amount of money leaving the country does create a certain amount of financial instability. It's
And I think it's connected culturally as well to, you know, to the CCP, the Communist Party, is that, you know, we've witnessed not just with gambling, but over the last couple of years, they've been targeting all kinds of what they term dissolute behavior. And I think this is tied up with, you know, obviously Xi wanting to retain power, wanting to eliminate his enemies, as it were, and eliminate any kind of competition, you know, for his succession. But partly it's also to bolster up the party to make sure that their guiding principles are actually based on, you know, some cultural principles and social principles, which are that, you know, people shouldn't misbehave. And this includes, you know, online gaming. It includes, obviously, online porn and many other things. I don't know how, you know, targeting, for example, superstars, maybe sports superstars, like the disappearance of that tennis superstar, whatever her name is. Sorry, not to know her second name. And yes. Maybe it's because, you know, it's because they're all becoming a bit too big for their boots and posting things and getting huge followings, and they don't like this, you know, because I suppose it puts power in different hands. But it's part of a bigger general crackdown on cross-border or out, you know, sort of cross-capital outflows rather, and general sort of cleaning up what they term dissolute behavior. So it's, you know, it's quite scary.
Exactly. Does it all, right. But I think the surprise was that they've gone after somebody who is as prominent as Alvin Chow. I mean, he is, you know, it's the biggest junket group in the world. I mean, it is the gold standard. I'm just trying to remember the percentage. They basically account for a huge chunk of Macau's VIP revenue, just the Sun City Group itself. So this really is sending a major signal to anybody who thought they might step out of line.
Does it bring the, is it like, if you look at everything that's going on or has been going on in Hong Kong, is it kind of related where if by targeting the junket operators, you obviously have a huge impact on the casino operators? And obviously the last time you spoke, there was, or the last time we spoke, it was talking about like, there was a lot of pressure for the American firms to reinvest in the local economy and stuff rather than just withdrawing, rather than just using Macau as an ATM machine for their global operations.
Yeah, this adds to the uncertainty for sure. I mean, all of the stocks were down yesterday very, very heavily, not just, well, the Sun City Group was suspended yesterday. Today, it's down about 48% as it's restarted trading. But yeah, there is a lot of uncertainty as to what China's view of the gaming industry actually is. Obviously, this is going to, in the short term, and probably actually put the nail in the coffin of the VIP business and the junket business. But there's also a bit of a wider question over what this means for the premium mass business, which was the sector that all of the casino operators have been targeting as being higher margin and the way the market has been evolving. But even here, it involves a certain amount of marketing in mainland China and how possible this might be following, because obviously marketing gambling in any way, shape or form in mainland China is absolutely forbidden. So, you know, it really leads to further question marks over just how far Beijing will go and what this means for the wider market. Like I said, I think in terms of the VIP market, it's not coming back.
Mm. And one of the things I read was that the Chinese government's looking at introducing their own cryptocurrency, so their own like digital renminbi. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah.
And one of the first use cases was actually casinos in Macau as a way of managing kind of capital flows and making sure everything's accounted for. Is that likely to happen, do you think?
The general feeling is it will happen. And the general feeling even before this was that probably would have been the sort of beginning of the end for the junkets. But it's not seen as a bad thing. It wasn't seen as a bad thing, and it ultimately could be quite a positive for the industry. But I think that's further down the road.
Got it. And can Macau recover from this, do you think? Like this, you know, the mass market and the premium mass market audience, do you feel like?
I think yes, as long as their long-term aim isn't to shut down the whole gaming industry in Macau, which I don't believe it is, although none of us can peer into the minds of the great CCP. But, you know, I think that there's been a push over the last few years to make it more mass focused, to make, you know, to diversify away from just gaming. Hengqin Island just across the water has been burgeoning. And so it's just, as Sharon said, it's another nail in the coffin, but the coffin had already been built for VIP gaming, I think. And, you know, so this is the trajectory is not a surprise. I think the surprise is the who and you know, the identity, as I say. But I think I read that junket or VIP play accounts for, what is it, Sharon? Around 34%?
It's around a third in the latest figures that we have, I think. Yeah. But so it's shrunk.
It's only about 8%. Is that right, Sharon?
Sorry, could you repeat that last bit? I didn't see.
So it's about 8%. Rent represents about 8% of their profits.
Yes.
PR-wise. So, you know, really, you know, they have been preparing for this. Maybe it's becoming a bit more swiftly and a bit more brutally than people had anticipated. But, you know, will it survive? I think the answer is definitely yes.
I don't think anybody thinks so. I mean, as Ros mentioned quite rightly, that the VIP revenue only really makes up about, yeah, like around 6 to 8% of the operator's EBITDA because of the high margin, the low margins involved in getting all these high rollers in, all the hotel rooms, you have to comp them and the drinks and all the rest of the perks they have. But that said, when you move to the mass market, it's also, if it's the grind mass market, you have to have a certain number of people to make up for that loss of revenue, and Macau just can't support the levels of visitation that would be needed to make up for the loss of the higher end sectors of the market. So nobody really thinks it's coming back to 2019 levels anytime soon. There's a lot of pessimism over whether or not we'll get back to those levels.
Looking at the other sort of the other standout story for me, which was the court ruling on the Wynn. Oh crap!
Wynn Resorts and Dore Entertainment.
Thank you very much. Yes, thank you for rescuing me.
This is why we bring in professionals.
Seriously. Can you tell us a little bit of that, about the background of that? Because I mean, it's not been a great couple of weeks, has it?
No. Do you want to go, Ros? Or
what? No, you.
Me. You're
probably closer to it. In brief, the courts found that Wynn was liable for junket debts, which is bad.
It's a very long running case, going back to, I think it was 2015, when a Dore cage manager made off with a bunch of clients' cash. And some of the clients, they've sued the companies. And basically, yes, the appeals court now, the final court, the highest court, has basically said that Wynn is jointly responsible with a junket operator for that debt, which again has created all kinds of legal issues for the operators in how they deal with the junkets who are on their properties. It's a very, you know, it already before this case of the arrest of Alvin Chow, it already had thrown a major spanner in the prospects for the VIP market.
Sharon, I mean, maybe people don't know that some people may not know that junkets, part of their role is to extend credit to their patrons. You know, and then I think I read somewhere that a lot of them have been diversifying, might have been Asia Gaming Brief. So they're looking to, you know, just become regular kind of tour operators, which I suppose is what the, you know, essentially what they were, is they did the marketing, they, you know, arranged all of the logistics, got the clients over to Macau, looked after them while they were there, you know, managed the money and took them back again. So, and also, so one is that the junkets will have to sort of go back to a more regular model of being a tour operator. And secondly, that although in light of what you just said about capacity, that the casinos might have to start looking outside of China for patrons, because they haven't had to. They really do an awful lot, apart from opening their doors, you know, and have floods of people coming. So what do you think about those two things, Sharon?
Well, let me see. I think that the idea that the junket operators, their future, if it's in Macau, will be little more than a glorified travel agent. Again, we come down to just how China is going to view Macau. You know, people thought that it wasn't part of the blacklist at all. China drew up a blacklist, I think it was last year, and keeps updating it with jurisdictions around Asia that are targeting Chinese nationals for gambling. It was always assumed that this was
Philippines. On that blacklist, right? Still?
Sorry, say that again, Ros, I didn't hear you.
But they still haven't published it. Like, so nobody knows for sure who's on that blacklist.
Exactly. Well, and now people are starting to think that maybe Macau is on that blacklist. Maybe they won't tolerate too much gambling when people come to Macau. There's already sort of whispers that some people who have been, some businessmen who've coming frequently to Macau, have been questioned as to why they're going. There's very much a changing visitor demographic to Macau. They're younger people, less inclined to gamble, more women. The figures are all showing the retail and the shopping side are going up, but the gross gambling revenue hasn't been keeping pace with visitation. So there are, you know, very big questions over what Beijing is going to actually tolerate. On your second point, yes, I suppose, but I'm not quite sure who could make up for the Chinese for Macau, really. And in the near term, not going to open their borders. So,
and it's very Chinese orientated Macau, isn't it? I'm not sure. I mean, yes, like, as you mentioned last time, Fintan, the Indian, you know, there were a lot of groups coming from India. I'm not sure whether that's still the case, probably not with COVID, but, you know, they have catered for different groups, but it is very Chinese focused.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely. I mean, it's just, maybe tourism authorities are trying very hard to diversify, looking at all kinds of things like medical tourism and sports tourism, but whether they can sort of entice people back from around Asia, because let's face it, you've got some pretty nice places to go around Asia, and unless you're a hardcore gambler, I'm not sure Macau would be top of my list, really.
For a tourist visit.
Does Macau, like, it sounds like then that we're kind of on the cusp of Macau doing the same kind of transition that Las Vegas did from, you know, it's a gambling destination to it's an entertainment destination.
They've been trying.
Yeah.
Oh, they've been trying. Okay.
That's exactly what the government wants. They want, you know, a family friendly, you know, mass market destination. That's going to be part of a tourist hub with Hengxin that Ros was just mentioning, just across the border. Their idea is that in Hengxin, you've got the space that you don't have in Macau, so you can build out lower star hotels, which are more attractive to people who don't have the funds to go to Macau. But at the end of the day, it's hard to know. So far, they've had really very, very little success in diversifying and to pushing up that quotient of non-gaming revenue. And whether they can do it or not, I mean, obviously it's like their hand's going to be forced, but whether there's enough in Macau to generate anything like the same levels of revenue.
Well, I think pre-COVID, there was definitely... I mean, when I've been in Macau, as in what I've seen with my own eyes, there's definitely been a significant rise in Indian tourists or South Asian tourists. And, you know, noticeable enough for me to go, oh, there are a lot more people from that region here now. You know, obviously I can't say what the numbers are. It's just, you know, seeing more people. I've seen a lot more Australians in recent years as well. But that's all pre-COVID, so God only knows what.
Australian people visiting, that's the thing, people working there?
Sorry, Ros?
Well, Australians who are visiting or who are working there?
Yeah, Australians who are visiting. They were using Macau, you know, the way people used to be with Singapore or Singapore or Hong Kong. They'd just stop over in Macau for a couple of days on their way somewhere else.
Definitely notice the Indian arrivals, but whether or not this is going to be, I just think COVID has sort of thrown a bit of a bombshell into all of that. And I think the government tourism office was pushing hard to open up new markets. And you're right, you used to see them, like great groups of them wandering around Sands. But they're so closed at the moment, it's hard to see how they can pick that up again in the short term.
Maybe there's an element of, you know, the term, I think it's disaster politics, where bad news is put through under the cover of worse news. Maybe there's going to be some strict enforcement going through while things are terrible with COVID to, you know, kind of cover up their awfulness. I mean, it's certainly something that the British government does a lot. Maybe there's an element of that in this, because the timing, business wise, it seems bonkers from outside. You know, Macau's on, I'm not going to say it's on the bones of its ass because they've been saving for a rainy day for a long time, but it's raining quite a lot.
Yes, and that's the thing where I think it goes back to what Ros was saying about the Communist Party elections coming up towards the end of next year. And Xi Jinping is definitely making sure everything is going the way he wants it to go. The common prosperity plan that he has in place basically has spared nothing. There doesn't seem to be any idea of too big to fail in China. It's just people were lulled into a very much false sense of security that Macau wasn't on the radar. To an extent, I think it is.
Also, I think I might be on the blacklist.
Which one?
We all might be after today.
Well, especially after what Sharon said, linking those two stories. Sharon. I was shocked.
Oh, dear.
Something that I have actually wanted you guys to talk about a little bit is about what AG Brief does and sort of your USPs, because I don't feel AG Brief is brilliant at shouting about itself and shouting about what you do. You're kind of burning along in the background, but it's the content I'm seeing is consistently excellent, and I think you should maybe just take a second to share about what you're doing, about the events and all of that stuff. Ros?
Right.
That's very gracious of you, John. And yes,
I've never been called that before, literally.
The content is mainly down to Sharon and also our Asia editor, Felix, who's based out in Sydney. Asia Gaming Brief was founded 9 years ago by Luis and I, and initially just an online publication, and then we branched out into a print magazine and started doing events as well. So our flagship event is the ASEAN Gaming Summit, which is going to be taking place again next March in Manila, Omicron and everything else notwithstanding. So essentially our role, what we see our role as is to provide information, but not just news, but intelligence about what's going on in the Asian gaming market. And that's why you'll see a lot of unique content in our newsletter, which has been researched and written mainly by our good Sharon, which isn't just picking up a news story from the wires. So you'll always get something unique and different. And then I think how we, the USP is that then we can compound that with our in-person events. So they go from little networking events, which is people getting together for drinks, to awards, to conferences. So the big one obviously being ASEAN, but we've also done events in Cambodia and we'll be planning other regions as well. So I think the point is that we want to provide intelligence to people about the Asian gaming industry and connections within that industry so they can go and find out more themselves.
Sweet. Is it a subscription service?
We do have a subscription service. The daily content is free to read by everybody. So you can sign up on the website, agbrief.com. And then we also have a subscription service, which is for every week we send out some longer articles, which are for our subscribers only. And those will go into in depth into a specific topic. Maybe Sharon can tell us about some of the recent things we've been looking at.
Yes, I'm just trying to rack my brains now. What have we've been obviously been very much focused on the developments in Macau, and it's more like trying to provide the news behind the news. So, you know, looking at the implications of all of this for the industry, the wider industry, the wider region, because we haven't really spoken about the wider region here. I mean, obviously, VIP gamers from China are a big part of all of the casinos across Asia. So, you know, we look at, you know, who's going to be affected, how, and all of that kind of stuff. But also cover online gaming as much as we can. We try and keep our pulse on that particular finger in Asia, which is an interesting one. I mean, it's only really legal in the Philippines, but there are other areas that are known to be potentially looking at legislating, COVID being that great leveler when it comes to persuading governments that they might need to raise a bit more revenue, given that people are doing it anyway. So, we cover regulation, all the regulatory impacts of what's been happening in Australia with all the Crown Group and Star Entertainment shakeout. The list is long and wide.
It's safe to say there's never a dull moment in Asian gaming, is there, Sharon?
No, there is not.
Fabulous. And this is that attitude, that approach is what makes you such great and respected guests, because the feedback that I've had from your appearances on this has been really excellent. So thank you very much for gracing us, frankly.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yeah, we're always delighted to chat with you, John and Fintan.
And we move on to our third and final guest of the day. We're delighted to be joined by a returning guest who, I don't know, maybe she's a daytime drinker. I'm just kidding. But seriously, there's got to be some reason why the excellent, fabulous and wonderful Jennifer Gaynor keeps coming back. Jennifer, do you just have too much time on your hands?
Apparently, but happy to be here.
Well, that's good for us, right?
Oh, hang absolutely. On.
It's very good for us. It makes us look amazing every time.
I think Fintan may have fallen asleep over there, but that's usually me. No, I'm kidding.
He did fall asleep once. It did happen.
It didn't happen, Jennifer.
It happened last week.
Didn't happen last week.
We'll just wait. We'll see if we can lull him to sleep today.
All you have to do is make sure that my feet are warm. It's the strangest thing. Like, if I put the heater on in the car and it's pointing at my feet, then I'm going to crash and kill us all.
I remember the first time I sat in a car with heated seats.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know there was heated seats.
Oh.
And I'm starting to panic because I think I've wet myself and I couldn't feel anything.
Yeah.
And it was the most awkward. I'm just sitting there and I'm starting to sweat now because, like, I'm like, oh my God. And then shame and embarrassment and burning red. And like, what have I, this, why are my legs warm? This is ridiculous. You're an adult. This shouldn't happen. And then eventually I'm like, this is a really fancy BMW, right? And he goes, yeah. And he goes, do you have heated seats? He goes, yeah, it's really cold outside. I thought it would warm us up. And just the relief that I hadn't wet myself.
So relieved that you'd pissed.
I nearly wet myself. I was so relieved.
I was in a hire car and it had heated seats, and I messaged Fern, my ex. I'm like, Fern, the hire car's got heated seats. And she just messaged back, I bet you thought you'd shit yourself, didn't you? And funnily enough,
you talk about shitting yourself quite a lot, John. Have you noticed that?
Well, you know, everybody has to have a passion. Because without passions and dreams, Fintan, life is empty. You heard me.
Deep.
So anyway.
Deep thoughts with John Bruford.
But you know what? There's a podcast waiting to happen. It would be a very short podcast. Deep thoughts with John Bruford, and then just be 3 minutes of silence. And then
silence.
It's like you bring the deep thoughts as the listener, and I'll provide the silence.
Wasn't there a meditation book that did that? And it was like each page just had one word on it, and it was just like breathe in, breathe out. And it was like just 200 pages of that.
That's brilliant.
This could work.
There's a market there, clearly. But Jennifer, you joined us today, not necessarily to talk about any exciting developments in North America, but to talk about your book, What You Wrote. Now, the book is, I'm not even going to say what the book's called because I always want to change a word in it. Jennifer, what's your book called, please?
It's called That Expletive Broad, Women Who Broke Barriers in the Casino and Gaming Industry. And I know you always want to fill in the expletive with the actual word used.
I really do.
I know. But you tried to convince me to use the actual word, you know, with using the, you know, the little symbols that they use to not write swear words like dollar sign, exclamation point. I thought about it.
Well, you know, I just think for your target market, we can handle the word.
Yes.
I think. I might be wrong.
Or what you could do is you do like a really limited edition special version.
Oh, with a hologram swear word.
The uncensored version. And you like just charge a gazillion dollars for it. It'd be perfect.
Sweet. Yes. It'd be like that Wu-Tang Clan album.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh. It would, though, to be fair, you know, I don't know what the actual word used, because this was taken from a real life story from one of the women that I wrote about in my book named Deborah Nutton. So she was one of the first female craps dealers on the Las Vegas Strip. She had recently graduated from college. She had been a nursing student, but she realized that there was more money to be made as a dealer on the Strip, you know, with cash tips and such. So she tried out for it and she actually got a job. But, you know, being one of the first female dealers on the Strip, you know, not all of her male colleagues were very happy to see her there. In fact, her boss told her that bending over the craps game will ruin your ovaries, which was funny because having just graduated with a degree.
That's happened to me.
You ruined your ovaries dealing craps.
Wrecked them.
Terrible. Yes. So she knew that wasn't true. And, you know, she continued to deal despite that. And at the age of 25, she was promoted to be a pit boss at the Sands. So, you know, again, not very popular with her male colleagues at the time. So they used to call her that beep broad. Instead of calling her by her name. So, you know, I don't know if it was an F beep or a, you know, GD beep, who knows? But, you know, I imagine they use lots of different words.
I think possibly that FBB, and I'm basing that on no knowledge of this at all, but one of my next door neighbors was once describing one of my other neighbors. And I'm going to have to use the actual word. So if there are any particularly sense to people
I'll
listening,
cover my ears.
We do mark this as explicit. But I'm going to have to go a little bit Shropshire with this as well. He's quite an old boy. And I mentioned one of my other neighbors and he just went, that fucking bitch bastard.
Wow.
It just stayed in my head.
I've heard that combination before.
That's why it stuck in my head. It was magnificent. It's like, do you know what, Derek? Say what you mean. Don't hold back. Don't feel you got to censor yourself in front of me. My God, yeah, the vitriol. I mean, it was spectacular. It was very, very good. But so it's about women that have kicked ass historically in Las Vegas.
Yes.
And there are quite a few.
Really in Las Vegas, though, a lot of them did end up in Las Vegas. It's women who have been the first to achieve something, to do something in the casino and gaming industry. Sure. Like, you know, Deborah Nutton, who I was talking about, she was one of the first, you know, females to deal craps on the Strip. And then she rose up through the ranks, despite all the males who weren't very happy to have her there, to become an executive with the MGM and the Wynn. And she went on to win a Great Women of Gaming Lifetime Achievement Award in 2018. And she's still there in the industry today, you know, on boards, mentoring women, et cetera, et cetera. So she had a stellar career.
I see. So the book came out last year, didn't it?
Yes, during the pandemic, which is a great time to launch something.
And it's a good time to catch up on your reading.
Yes.
So have you been able to retire as a lawyer and just sit and count your money from the book?
Sadly, no. But every once in a while, Amazon will send me a little check and it makes me happy. So
they don't even send you giant checks.
No. Like the ones that you give to charities. It's actually direct deposit, but
even more disappointing. but has the book done okay? I mean, has it been well received?
It has been well received. And I think what was most important to me is that it was well received by the women that I wrote it about. A number of them, like Sandra Douglas Morgan and Becky Harris and, Patricia Becker, they were women that I was able to interview directly, in person and give them copies of the book. And, they all very much appreciated it. And, I think that the intention behind the book was not to become a, Times bestseller. It really was to just make sure that the stories of these women were written down somewhere and remembered. Because I think, having worked in the casino and gaming industry for, more than 15 years myself, I always heard the stories about, who built the gaming industry. And it was all, Steve Wynn, et cetera, et cetera. You hear about the guys in the casino, the movie Casino, all that stuff. And you never hear about the women who were there. And you wondered, were women part of building Las Vegas? Were women part of building this industry? What role have they played? And so I did a little research and I was actually really happy to find a number of stories of really impressive women who did amazing things. And I found it very inspirational to write. And, it's really my goal to just put it out there, commemorate their stories, and maybe inspire a few women along the way.
So is your book written in case of a zombie apocalypse? Do you have a favorite in there? I mean, if I made you choose, if I had some way to influence you like that, what would your top of the pile pioneer be?
It's hard to say. God, how would I pick one? I think the one that surprised me, the story that I didn't think that I would like and I actually considered not putting in the book, but then I found really interesting in the end, was Eleanor Dumont. And she was back in the Wild West days. My first chapter of the book focuses on women because gaming's been around, of course, in the U.S. longer than Las Vegas. So, at first I looked at the women who were card dealers and card players back in the times of the gold rush and the mining camps and all the gaming that was going on there. And one of those women was Eleanor Dumont, or Madame Mustache. And she became famous playing and dealing the card game 21. And she ran gaming establishments and dealt games across the mining towns of America during the gold rush. And, she built up quite a reputation for herself as, just a real card shark. And she was, highly respected amongst the mainly male gamblers that she played with. But, the sad thing is, in the end, she ended up broke and alone, and she lost all the money she had borrowed playing cards. And she went off to the desert and drank poison and killed herself. So at first I thought, that's not very inspirational, right? I think you could agree.
No, that is fair. I think that would possibly be seen as I believe our American cousins say, something of a bummer.
Yes, something of a bummer. But the thing is, after her death, men traveled from hundreds of miles away. She died in a mining camp up in Bodie, California, up in Northern California. But people came from, Carson City, from Nevada, from hundreds of miles away to celebrate her and to remember her. And I think that if she had realized how well-respected she was by so many, how loved and respected she was, she wouldn't have done what she had done. And I think a lot of times, we're so in our own heads and we're so hard on ourselves that we don't realize like how other people perceive us. And so like her story, was kind of inspirational to me in that way.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I was kind of hoping for a second there when you were like, after her death. I thought you were going to say, after her death, she rose up. She rose up and attacked the people that had made her unhappy. But unfortunately, no zombies in this story.
But as far as like inspirational and as far as what they did, you know, I think my favorite thing, you know, and I want to say character, but these were real people. Was Claudine Williams. So I don't know if you've ever heard of her, but Claudine Williams is a high school dropout who started working at the age of 12. She was raised by a single mom. Her dad had ran out, you know, when she was a small child. And she talked her way into working at a supper club, and this was in Louisiana, at the age of 16. And so she started working at the door, but she kept asking to learn to deal. And so she became the first female dealer at that supper club in Louisiana. And, you know, she ended up talking her way into working eventually for Benny Binion in Texas, where she learned more skills like learning how to write for a sports book, how to deal craps, and how to deal other games. And she ended up owning and running a casino in Las Vegas and becoming, a board member for Harrah's and having an absolutely stellar career as well, and really having a large impact on the gaming industry. So, you know, it goes to show you can come from nowhere and do amazing things.
You mentioned some contemporary names in there. Sandra Douglas Morgan stands out. Mm-hmm. I might have to find the right way to phrase this because, of course, I took the precaution of not preparing any notes.
Excellent.
What I'm getting at here is, whenever I think of the gambling industry, I always think that there are an awful lot of women in senior positions and yet, even in gambling, we still have organizations to promote mentorship, to promote the betterment of women in senior roles in management positions. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought it's one of those things, I guess, where because I'm not a part of that demographic that has historically suffered or that is slighted in some way, I'm probably not tuned into any casual sexism or misogyny that is around me, if you see what I mean.
yes.
What John's trying to say is we're white middle-aged men. We haven't got a clue.
Fundamentally, that is what I'm dancing around. But is there, do you think, is there a glass ceiling or is there a ceiling? Are there still obstacles for women in gambling, given how many, frankly, fucking brilliant women there are in this industry, and it is full of talent and intelligence, are there still barriers for women?
I mean, I think not like there were historically, and I think it's because of these barrier-breaking women, you know, who have put themselves there when they weren't necessarily wanted, that have paved the way for, you know, women today. I think it's definitely a lot fewer barriers than they used to be. But, you know, one of the things that we need to work on is getting women into the C-suite, the executive roles. You know, I think there's a lot of siloing. Like you see a lot of women executives and like human resources and departments like that. And a lot of, you know, men who are CEOs, COOs type of roles. So, you know, that's something that, you know, needs to change, I think, from the bottom down. You know, you need to start training more women to run everything on the floor, to get into, you know, the different departments, the different parts, to do IT, to do security, to do the roles they didn't necessarily do. Otherwise, you would just end up with, you know, women in certain roles, but not other ones. So I think that's one thing you need to do. And, you know, and one thing I saw in this book was a lot of these women, they had men who believed in them, who coached them, who mentored them, who trained them, who believed in them, without whom, you know, they wouldn't necessarily have gotten where they were. You know, look at Becky Harris and Sandra Douglas Morgan. Becky Harris was the first female chair of the Nevada Gaming Control Board. The board was founded in 1955. The first member of the board was Patty Becker in 1983. And then the first woman chair was Becky Harris, and this was in 2018. So that's more than 60 years before you saw the first female chair of the Gaming Control Board. And that wouldn't have come around unless the Nevada governor at the time, Brian Sandoval, had appointed her. You know, so you need men to help women to get into those positions in the first place, if that makes sense.
Well, it makes perfect sense because it's how men get ahead as well, right? So, you know, if you take that example of the control board, every previous chair would have been a man appointed by another man. So It makes, when you say it like that, it's like, of course, that's really obvious. But like John said, we've never thought about it because we're middle-aged men.
I had Becky Harris on as a guest of the Bruford Files, which was episode 14. And like I finished the interview and I was just like, I was reminded of something. I was doing, I used to edit a DVD magazine, and I was at a press thing at the Deauville Film Festival in Northern France. And I was there to go to a dinner to mark the Lifetime Achievement Award of a producer named Jerry Weintraub, who's he was an astonishing man. He was absolutely incredible. But I was chatting with another journalist there, a dude called Almar Hafliðason. To those in the know, you will be of no surprise that he's of Icelandic descent. And we were talking about interviews we'd done. We were talking about favorite interviews we'd done with people. And I was like, well, I think Bruce Campbell's probably one of my absolute favorites. And he said, oh, Jackie Chan is mine. He said, I've never interviewed anybody else and thought while I was talking to them, oh my God, you're so much better than me. And he said, and I was sitting there interviewing Jackie Chan. And that's all I had in my head was, you're just so much better than me. And that's actually how I felt when I was interviewing Becky Harris, because she's just, it's her attitude. It's the way that she doesn't see obstacles. She just sees something she wants to do. She goes away. She learns how to do it. She comes back. She absolutely crushes it. Mm-hmm. And that's a glorious quality to have regardless of gender. I don't know. I mean, you speak to some women in the gambling industry and you say, you know, is there other issues, other obstacles? And they'll say, no, just fucking roll your sleeves up and work hard. And other women will say, well, you know, historically there's this. I don't know what the solution is, but what I think is that it's 2021. Should we really still be having these conversations? So shouldn't we be past this by now?
You know, I think we are moving past this. We are in the right direction. You know, I think the pandemic and the, you know, recession and the people who lost jobs in the gaming and tourism industry were disproportionately women. And I think in a lot of cases, it's because the women are the primary childcare givers. And I think, you know, maybe not where you are, but in the U.S., one of the big problems we have is that, you know, our companies do not treat workers well when it comes to parents and to having time off, you know, for a new baby, to have time off to deal with sick children, to have time off to deal with ailing parents. You know, We just don't have the leave policies that you need. And so long as women, you know, remain the primary caregivers, I think that's going to be a big problem. And it is something that holds women back.
There was a comedian called Sean Locke in the UK who I think he died this year. He's a very funny man, but very perceptive. And he said, they say that a woman's work is never done. Perhaps that's why you don't get paid as much as we do.
It's true. But, you know, women like Becky Harris, you know, they really do drive us forward. And, you know, it doesn't matter if she's a woman or a man, you know, Becky Harris has that bulldog mindset, and she's going to get where she's going. And nothing's going to stand in her way. You know, I became friends with her, but I remember, you know, when I first met her, she was a state senator up at the Nevada state legislature. And I was a lowly lobbyist, you know, trying to accomplish things for my clients. And we were, you know, at loggerheads on a certain issue, on a certain bill. And, you know, that was the toughest fight of my life that I've ever had, was, you know, trying to keep this language out of this bill that Becky had wanted in there. So, you know, at first we were adversarial, but, you know, over time we became friends, and I think we came to respect each other. But I have a ton of respect for her. She's, you know, she was sitting as a state senator, and that's when she decided that she wanted to learn more about gaming. She was sitting in a hearing on a bill. I think it was Senate Bill 9, and it had to do with skill-based gaming. And she asked a question about whether a fantasy football operator could come into Nevada under the proposed legislation. And, you know, she said it's been considered to be skill-based and legal in some jurisdictions. And everyone in the room was like, no. And she realized at that point that she didn't know as much about gaming as the people in the room. And she wanted to learn because she knew it was an important industry for the state of Nevada. So she took it on herself to go and get an LLM in gaming, which is like an advanced law degree in a certain specific topic, in this case, gaming. She got herself an internship at the Gaming Control Board, and she taught herself all about the gaming industry and, you know, ended up becoming appointed as the chair of the board. So it just goes to show, you know, when you have that kind of determination and drive, where you can go.
It's very true. And the Bruford Files interview between myself and Becky Harris is actually still up there. It's still live. So if anybody wants to listen to it, she's very interesting.
She is. She's interesting. She's inspirational. You know, I've always thought she would get back into politics, run for Nevada governor one of these days. You know, we'll see.
I would be very sad, but it's the right thing at the right time, kind of coming into her field of vision and just being that thing that she latches onto. Because whatever she applies that brain to, it's going down. In the nicest way.
It is, in the nicest way. Like Becky will get, you know, what she's interested in, you know, where she's going, she will get there. 100%.
I totally didn't mean to fanboy there, but that's just what happens when you mention people like that.
I kind of fangirl a little bit when I talk to her or Sandra Douglas Morgan. You know, I totally fangirl out on her. Like, she's pretty amazing herself.
I have not met Sandra Douglas Morgan. Obviously, I know a little bit about her career. And I would probably totally fanboy there as well. Because again, she's somebody that just seems to most of us, you would label it overachieving. Mm-hmm. But to her, it's just a regular day. Vincent, do you know any of these people that we're talking about?
I haven't got a clue, but it sounds fascinating. I take it back. I did listen to your podcast, because she was the senator and then she was a judge and stuff as well. It was a really good story.
Yeah, that wasn't the judge. That was a different one. But
oh, was it? Okay, sorry.
No, you're thinking of Judge Cheryl. Who doesn't know Judge Judy, which we established in the interview? I'd like to get Judge Cheryl on this, though, because she was terrific. Fascinating lady. Sorry, digressing slightly there. And it would keep up my record of having people on here that I've had on the Bruford Files. sorry, I'll get my coat. Jennifer, something that we mentioned just before we started recording, things actually have happened in America a little bit in terms of iGaming markets and stuff. Is there anything exciting that we should hear about North America?
You know, North America, we're doing well, you know, when it comes to the gaming market. You know, sports betting is continuing to spread across the country. And, you know, like I've always said, for Nevada, rising tide, you know, raises all ships. And so it's just increasing sports betting here in Nevada as well. You know, even though that's never been the point of gambling in Nevada, you know, sports betting has always been an amenity, you know, provided to customers because it's something that they want to see or expect to see, but not because you make that much money off of it. But it's still growing. And, you know, revenue overall is growing. In fact, the AGA recently came out with the report saying that U.S. casinos are on track to break revenue records in 2021. Our nation's commercial casinos won nearly $14 billion in third quarter alone. and Nevada casinos won over $1 billion last month alone. So, you know, records being set left and right. You know, and it's not just up from pandemic levels, but we're up from where we were in 2019 before the pandemic. I think, what are we, up 24.7% from Q3 2019. So 2021 is on track to be the highest grossing year in the history of U.S. commercial gaming.
That just sounds absolutely bonkers considering what's going on worldwide and, you know, so many places are still suffering so much with COVID, but gaming just seems to have, God, I don't even know how you begin to describe it. I mean, it's tremendous, don't get me wrong.
Well, it's almost
the speed of it's what's surprising.
Well, I think it's like liquor during Prohibition, right? Everyone was locked down. Everyone was not happy to be locked down. So the first taste of freedom, you know, it's like the roaring 20s again.
Yeah. Even allow for that, do you know what I mean? I would have expected that to have calmed down a little bit by now. So for October to be such a massive month, mm-hmm. what's November going to be like? What's hotel occupancy going to be like in November? Because Thanksgiving usually does pretty well in terms of people traveling to Vegas.
Numbers. Yeah, I haven't seen the numbers for November yet, but I'm pretty sure our occupancy is not quite where it was pre-pandemic. Let me look. I pulled up some of the numbers from the Las Vegas Visitors and Convention Authority because they track the visitors to Las Vegas every month. So visitors are up. September 2021, we had 2.9 million visitors, and that was up from 1.2 in January 2021. So that's trending back up. But I think our room occupancy is still less than 80%. And normally, I believe we were always over 90%, 95% historically. So, you know, we're still not there. The conventions still aren't there. The international travel still not there. And with the new variant, what is it, South African, North African, the new variant?
No, it was first recognized in South Africa. It didn't actually start there. As South African people are being very quick to point out to the world. But
it has a name, doesn't it? Like Omicron?
Yeah,
what is it called?
Omicron, something like that, yeah. It's something that is pleasantly generic. Let's call it Derek.
The Derek variant.
Yes. Derek has there are three Dereks in the UK at the moment. Or three recognized Dereks in the UK. And if they found three, then there are obviously more.
I heard there was even a couple of Dereks in Australia, and they've been pretty good about locking people out. So,
Yeah. So, I mean, Derek gets everywhere. And Derek will get everywhere ultimately. And yeah, we'll see. I think it's going to pose a threat to ICE, which is due to be the first week of February. I think if I were the organizers of ICE, I would be getting very, very nervous right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because Brexit is going to cause its own issues for ICE and for companies bringing their products in from the continent. And that will be compounded by the fact that some people simply aren't going to be able to come in or will be barred from visiting the UK by their countries if this takes a hold. But we'll see. I mean, we've got to be optimistic. The vaccination program's been tremendous. And yeah, I guess we shouldn't piss and moan until we know what we're pissing and moaning about. And then we can piss and moan all we want.
It's true. I mean, I think you'll agree that COVID is here to stay for a while. It's going to be something we're going to be vaccinated against, getting boosters against for possibly years to come.
Yeah. And it's going to be a question of managing it and learning to live with it and hopefully not getting it. Yeah.
Yes.
Because I'm not. I know people are like, oh well, I had a sniffle. Well, you know, some people are really lucky. I know one dude. He caught it in March. He is still having symptoms. It is November.
Mm-hmm.
So it does seem to hit everybody in a completely different way. I mean, Fintan, it's given you long, dark, thick, curly hair. I'm hoping for that strain.
Yeah, it's definitely hit me hard in the head. All right. But like I had a friend who got it and he was on a ventilator. He was kind of one of the first wave, big, strong, and then took him a year to recover, just to get kind of back to sort of regular life. You know, it can hit people in lots of different ways.
Screw that. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't like wearing a mask. I don't particularly like the isolating side of it and all that. But I like all of that better than I like being on a ventilator. And so that's a very easy equation for me.
Well, I dropped my son off to school this morning. And so there's some new Dutch restrictions kicked in Sunday. And one of them is that the kind of 8, 9, 10-year-olds all have to wear masks, but moving between classrooms and moving around the building and stuff. And all the kids were standing outside wearing the mask, no messing around. They just did it and got on with it, kind of thing. So if a 10-year-old can do it, anybody can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. I hope all the resignation that was in my heart came out in that year, because it's just... It's become this new divisive thing, and every possible issue that we seem to have to face as animals now seems to have become weaponized and used for division. And that's the part I'm tired of. I'm not tired of people rallying and helping the community and all of those things. I'm tired of people using it as means for further division. Instead of looking at the commonality is that we are all facing this. The division is, I don't want to wear a mask. Okay, fine, then don't wear a mask. But we're all facing this. Yeah, don't bring your fucking hairy ass near me, frankly. But, you know, on the other hand, it has probably been a real bonus for people suffering halitosis. So, you know what I mean? Swings around a bit.
With cold sores. People with cold sores also benefiting.
It's been huge for them. People with unsightly facial hair or bad teeth. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm basically speaking about English people, which is because that's all of us pretty much. There are pluses and minuses, I think, in every transaction.
It's true. You know, John, just total aside, but I'll tell you, I love the show, The Great British Baking Show.
Oh, Great British Bake Off, yeah.
Yeah, so I have seen what, British teeth look like in the wild.
Yeah, we're pretty proud.
It's amazing. In America, we're all about, you know, braces, straight, white. You know, you can't be straight and white enough here.
Well, that's shown in your entertainment industry, frankly. On every level of being straight and white.
I saw what I did there.
It was beautiful, frankly. But Great British Bake Off, it's become an institution. And for anybody not in the know, it's a bunch of people in a tent making cakes. But it's better than I'm making it sound.
Why are they in a tent?
I'm not actually sure about that part, but they are genuinely under a marquee.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's not a tent.
It's a field.
Yeah, they're in a field, basically, making cakes.
I was thinking like this little two-man tent, and they're trying to make a souffle or something.
Now you're talking. Somebody jostling somebody at the wrong moment, and you get a bit of white in there. I'm trying to separate the yolk. I'll cut you.
There's a sheep nibbling the tent as they're standing there. Okay.
They were thinking about doing an American version, and so everybody would use a semi-automatic rifle to cook the cakes. I'll get my
add
coat.
A little meth for flavor, yes.
Now you're talking, a bit of meth sauce. We've really digressed here. Jennifer, thank you for joining us and talking about some of the characters in your book. The book is called That Expletive Broad. I can't remember the long part of the title. Jennifer, what's the name of the book, please?
That Expletive Broad, Women Who Broke Barriers in the Casino and Gaming Industry.
And is that available from all good bookshops?
It is.
Excellent.
Type it in, just Google it, you'll find it.
And that's by Jennifer Gaynor, attorney and founder of J. Gaynor Law. See what I did there.
Yes.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you for humoring us with Chit Chat.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Jennifer.
And if you've enjoyed the podcast, please remember to like, subscribe, and share with friends, colleagues, your parents, enemies. And we'll see you next time.